The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, who is on his way to Ireland already. Actually, knowing how short the plane flight is, he may well have already arrived. And it is a very busy day here at Edstone, getting ready for the PAC, the Public Appearance Campaign lecture in Belfast this weekend. We've been loading up the car this morning. It looks like everything is going to fit. Getting all of our different sound elements and things like that lined up. So if you're going to be there, we're really looking forward to seeing you. And if not, well, we've got the online public appearance campaign in just another week. So look out for that. I think we've got more and more material going on about that on our website. And if you sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief emails, then we can make sure that you get notified about that. Well, I think this is the first time I've been in the studio with some of our additional props. It's a little dangerous when doing radio. It's kind of easy to forget that there's anybody listening or anybody watching, but we've got the TV camera on here for the YouTube stream, so I'll have to resist the temptation to keep picking up the boat and playing with it as I talk. And the mug is unfortunately empty. We need to start filling that with coffee or something. Well, there's lots going on in the news. I think more and more the challenge when putting together these Trumpet Daily segments isn't what to talk about. It's more about what to leave out, what to not talk about. There is so much going on. And today I think we'll kind of range all around the world looking at some of the big stories from this week. So much is happening. So much is going on. Things that very rarely get covered in some places, in some cases. So we'll move through some things pretty quickly, but I think there's still benefit in doing this. It really is remarkable. You know, where everywhere you look, it matches the forecasts that we've been making, that Herbert W. Armstrong was making for years and years before, you know, on the Bible, based on the Bible. And you know, it's everywhere you look. It's not like we're kind of cherry-picking a few examples of things that tie in with what he said. It's just, you know, the whole worldview that Mr. Armstrong talked about, again, because of revealed truth from the Bible, that whole worldview that we talk about, that he talked about, well, that's what you get when you look at the world today. And more are seeing that, though, you know, they don't credit the Bible for describing it, but they see some fundamental changes in the world, changes that we've been talking about for a long time. Well, we'll start in Germany just with some of the most imminent, immediate piece of news. There was a far-right shooting attack in Germany very recently, just I think overnight. 10 people were killed in the German city of Hanau. There was I guess it looks pretty likely he was a far-right gunman. He opened fire at a couple of shisha bars, and it looks like he was going after Turks, or at least Muslims, in this attack. I think there are four that are wounded as well. The German press have named the suspect as Tobias R., a German national. And he left behind some material. I think he left behind a letter and a video that, you know, well, I make it very clear that he was kind of into, it was on the far right and into conspiracy theories. One of the reports talked about how the letter says that he felt he needed to go and destroy communities which could no longer be expelled from Germany. So he was going out of his way to try and destroy some of these immigrant communities. He was into some kind of crazy conspiracy theories. In the video, I think he was ranting about secret underground bases in the US where children are tortured. The German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, he said the horrific crime in Hanau would be the third far-right murder attack in Germany in the space of a year. Far-right terrorism is a threat to our country once again. And then a bit later, he said democracy must stand up against the enemies of freedom. There's another gentleman that was quoted in some of the news reports, Niels Duket, senior researcher at the Flemish Peace Institute. I think he spoke to Deutsche Welle. He said, it's clear there seems to be a problem with public shootings in Germany. You had this Rot-am-See shooting a few weeks ago, the Halle shooting a few months ago. He said, what police forces have been noticing across Europe is that they fear that far-right extremism is on the rise and that these people can also have access to guns, both legally and illegally. That raises the alarm. The president for the German Central Council of Jews, Josef Schuster, he said for too long the danger from the far right wing in Germany has been trivialized and neglected. He said police and the justice system appear to often have a blind spot in their right eye. He talks about we're seeing the results of that. Just this week, we're getting ready to finish up the next edition of the Trumpet Print Magazine. In theory, I think that all goes out today at the end of the day. And one of the things I've been working on for that is an article talking about the parallels between now and the 1930s. I think it's something that pops up in quite a few of the articles that we've had, but it's been a while since we've really devoted an article to that. And there are some really powerful lessons from history, warnings from history, if you go back and look at what was happening in the 1930s. And I didn't get into it so much in this article because I was kind of focused more on the politics. But the rise in far-right violence was absolutely something you saw in the 1930s as this mindset became more entrenched, became more popular, became society moving to the extreme. And then, of course, you also have the very real problem of Islamic extremism. And you've had some attacks in Germany and in all of Europe, almost this steady level of, I don't know what to say, low level of attacks. I mean, there have been some pretty huge attacks over the last few years. And then there have been other people that have tried to kill a lot of people and maybe not been as successful at that. But certainly a steady danger of Islamic extremist attacks, and with Muslims reaching for things like trucks or rental cars to try and kill people. And then you have this far right response and this violent response, and you can really see how that could build off each other as each community responds to the other. And you have the very real danger of more violence, and then just this increase in extremism. And well, you can keep an eye out for that Trumpet print edition I talk about in there, is the parallels that you do see with the 1930s, but then also how the Bible says there's going to be a few differences as well in terms of what happens within Germany. But the Bible makes it absolutely clear that we're heading for a strong man in Germany. And I think the way you see all of the instability and the violence that is going to make Germans, and is already making Germans, want a strong man in power. Just one of the articles I saw today talked about the for all of Europe wanting a superman, wanting a strong man to come and save them from a whole lot of these problems. So keep watching that in Germany, and we'll come back to the situation in Germany probably in the second half of the show. There's another trend that I think has been very clear in some of the articles this week. That's this rise of mob rule and mob violence, particularly in the UK and Canada, just in this last week. That has shown up. You had this situation in England this week where Extinction Rebellion, this kind of extremist group of protesters that has been, you know, they've been making the news for a year or two now, and they try to do these extreme acts to gain attention to themselves and the climate emergency that they talk about. So in Cambridge, they were up there and they were digging up lawns where normally, you know, if you even walk on their lawns, someone is going to come and stop you, an authority figure even from the university or the police, because you're not allowed to walk on the lawns. They were closing roads. And instead of confronting what they were doing, the police were allowing it. They were helping it. You know, they were standing by and letting them go and dig up these beautiful, immaculate lawns in Cambridge when they tried to protest by stopping traffic and lying down on the roads and whatever they were doing. The police closed the roads. Because that way they didn't have to arrest them. You know, interfering with traffic and trying to shut down roads, well, that's a criminal offense. The police have to do something. But if they shut the roads and use emergency powers to shut the roads, well, then they don't have to step in. And so the police really were helping these protesters disrupt society rather than hurting them. And you saw the same over the summer in the UK, where you had Extinction Rebellion protesters in London, and the police in some cases and senior figures certainly were more supportive of their kind of mob rule than they were opposing them. The Telegraph wrote, "These huge shocks for residents like me, or the huge shock for residents like me is that bodies we thought would protect our interests, the council or the police, have behaved as if they're on the side of those disrupting our way of life. They're helping the mob. They're helping the protesters." And then the Canada Post, or the National Post in Canada, had this article from John Iverson. "Canada is turning into a mob city while Trudeau remains silent." And it says, "Canada is slowly turning from democracy to mobocracy as the rule of law is tested from close to close. From blocked intersections in downtown Toronto to journalists and legislators being barred entry to the BC legislature, from an obscure CN line affecting rail traffic out of the port of Prince Rupert to the barricades impeding via rail service between Toronto and Montreal, Canada is being slowly choked into submission." The article talks about these particular protests. He said that they're in solidarity with the opposition to the Coastal GasLink pipeline in northern BC by hereditary chiefs of the, I'm not even going to try and say that Indian tribal name, but anyway, some tribe over there. But a considerable number of outsiders are using this dispute as an excuse for mischief. There's a hashtag, I guess, that they've been launching on Twitter, hashtag #ShutDownCanada, as they try and promote this. I've been talking to people to fight mega extraction and colonialism. And this article writes, "The mob is winning. CN has temporarily closed down parts of its network and warned of threats to transportation of food, grain, de-icing fluid for airports and propane for Quebec and Canada." And he just talks about how the leadership isn't really doing anything to deal with these protesters. And that's the message more and more is, well, if we kind of agree with you, we'll let you do whatever we like. You know, if it's a trendy cause like climate change, well, yeah, we're more than happy to go ahead and let you do whatever protests, whatever disruptions, whatever vandalism you like. Now, you could be sure if these were, say, pro-Brexit protesters here in the UK doing what these people are doing, well, the authorities would come down on them like a ton of bricks. Yeah, no question. But because they're on these trendy sources, causes, they're allowed to do whatever they like. It reminds me of some of those statements you saw coming from the Obama administration, talking about giving the protesters space to destroy. There's just that same lack of will to uphold the law that you saw under Mr. Obama in the United States. And you see it in the UK, you see it in Canada. And it's just going to make these protests worse. They see that there's no will to uphold the law. The government's not they're not going to try and confront those that break the law. And so that's just going to lead to more law-breaking, more mob rule, more of this violence trying to impose their will on the rest of society. And that's just going to lead to more division, more weakness in our countries. And it's an important story to watch in the social decline of our countries. Another story I'll talk about from the UK, there was an interview on Good Morning Britain this week that's gotten a huge amount of attention in the press, where the Labour Party, they're going through, they're electing a new leader, someone to replace Jeremy Corbyn as their main left leader, leader of the main left-wing party. And this is what one of their top spokesmen, one of their shadow cabinet members, their top leaders, this is what she said about transgenderism when being interviewed on Good Morning Britain. This is clip 7.
When a child is born, they are identified and observed in a particular sex.
A child
sex,
is born
they?
Without sex, and the child is formed without sex, yeah, in the beginning. But
I don't hold these opinions. I'm just wondering why the Labour Party has decided that it's not possible to have a discussion about them, and you're closing the discussion down.
No, we haven't decided that you can't have a discussion about it. We're saying that you can have a discussion about it, but the Labour Party should and must be a safe space.
Yes, of course.
So you cannot have dog whistle transphobia. You cannot have dog whistle anti-Semitism. You cannot have dog whistle racism.
So somebody who thinks that there is a biological misogyny difference is a dog whistler, aren't they? I mean, because a lot of people who are very powerfully in support of transgender do think that there is a biological difference. You may not agree with them, I'm not sure I do, but they do think that.
But as long as you're having a debate without being transphobic, then you can have a discussion and a debate. Mm. Trans women are women.
That was that interview where the senior politician there was saying, well, no, babies are born without sex. They're not born as a boy or a girl. They're born, I guess, as an it or something. And then they gradually acquire being a boy or being a girl. And this, you know, this is not an extreme position in the UK anymore. You can see that that interviewer was kind of terrified of himself saying, well, I disagree with you. He was very clear to put these... Well, I'm not saying this, but you could see some people potentially saying this. He was too nervous even to associate himself with some of those questions. But you've seen a lot just in this week along the lines of this same story. There was a headline over the weekend, NHS endorsing guide for transgender patients that approves puberty blockers and declares anatomy is not always a good guide to determining a child's sex. So this is coming straight from the NHS, the National Health Service, basically talking about doing all of these things that do real harm to teenagers, to, you know, embracing some of the most radical aspects of the transgender movement. You had another story. This was on Friday. In some ways, it was going a little in the right direction, where about a year ago, you had a former policeman. He tweeted, I was assigned mammal at birth, but my orientation is fish. Don't misspecies me. So obviously making a joke at the expense of this movement there. And he was arrested for that. The police came and interviewed him. Or they visited him. I guess I don't know whether he was quite arrested. They told him he committed no crime, but the police said, we need to check your thinking. You know, we're not sure of your thinking is right there. It was recorded as a tweet incident, as a non-crime hate incident. And so he launched legal action against what the police were doing. And then it was on Friday that the police ruled, or the courts ruled that what the police did was not lawful. But again, it's just bringing this madness that you see right to the forefront of the news this week. And another really important trend in the decline of family. And Mr. Flowey spoke about that Atlantic article yesterday briefly. I think it was by David Brooks, about the decline of the nuclear family, or the end of the nuclear family. I can't remember the exact title, where going through that article, he had some fantastic statistics about showing how family had declined, divorce rates going through the roof. I mean, I say fantastic statistics. They're not, I should say revealing statistics. It's not good news at all. But he did a great job in doing some of the research and showing how family was declining. But then for half of his article, his conclusion isn't, well, we need to oh, there we go. The nuclear family was a mistake. They've got it up on the YouTube screen for me now. Thank you, guys. But his conclusion wasn't, okay, well, the things that we've been doing have been destroying the family. We need to change. What can we do to fix this? Because that would have been a great article. No, instead, the nuclear family is being destroyed. Well, we need to try something new, experiment with something completely different that still upholds modern values and transgenderism and conforms to all of that. We need to try something new. Which, it's just a crazy and a dangerous mindset. You know, this is what has held society together. And, well, it doesn't conform with some of our ideals right now. So we've got to get rid of it. And we've got to come up with we've got to start experimenting with some other foundation of society and hope that it works. But this decline of family, it's a major part in the decline of Britain and America. You know, so many of just the practical problems that we face trace back to the decline of family. I mean, even the spending problems and the way that both countries have this massive welfare state that's there because families are no longer there to step in and help when people come into trouble, when an elderly individual needs care or somebody's sick they get some kind of long-term sickness and they need help or they can't work for a long period of time. Well, the family's no longer there to be able to do that. And so we've got this massive, inefficient, bloated welfare system to step in. And that's really one of the least of the problems caused by family breakdown. You've got the massive crime that we see and so many other things traced directly back to this kind of massive family breakdown. But instead, we're just going full steam ahead into more and more of this. Another area of weakness for Britain and America, this is a headline from Vital Interests. Are we headed to an ignoble end in Afghanistan? Something else you've seen over the last week or so, the United States pulling out of Afghanistan, the United States pulling back from there. I think it was, well, I've got it later on, a little later on in my notes. Last Friday, The U.S. announced that they'd reached an agreement for a temporary reduction in violence with the Taliban. And this is designed to be just a step towards a peace treaty with the Taliban. So, okay, well, if they stick with this, then we'll sign a peace treaty with the Taliban, with this terrorist group. And this article talks about how America's been trying to get concessions from the Taliban as part of this peace treaty. But it says, but the Taliban, this is the vital interest piece, but the Taliban isn't in the concessions business. The State Department is. The talks have taken place entirely on the Taliban's terms. The Taliban demanded that the Afghan government be excluded from the negotiations, and the US quickly acquiesced in 2018. This means that the internationally recognized government, which American taxpayers have spent billions of dollars to stand up, wasn't even granted a formal seat at the table in Doha where the agreements were hashed out. So they've been getting a whole lot of what they demand. The article talks about how the Taliban has steadfastly refused to recognize the Afghan government's legitimacy. They talked about how the Taliban is fighting to create its own Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, or the IEA, which is the same regime that the US went to war with in 2001 and supposedly destroyed or won. The Taliban are negotiating to get that all back, and America's negotiating with them for that. They said that the Taliban's insurgency is stronger than ever, meaning that the jihadists are positioning themselves to overthrow the Afghan government. On February 11th, so pretty recently, the Taliban released a lengthy video declaring the US a spent force and crowing about its accomplishments. The production opened with a clip of President Trump saying the American people are weary of war without victory. And so this is the message that they're sending. Well, America's weary of war. They're going to leave and they're going to give us everything I want. And then it talks about how, well, America's saying, oh, but the Taliban's going to give us permission. If we sign this peace treaty, they'll give us permission to go and fight against terrorist groups. This article calls that idea preposterous. They write that in September, for instance, a joint U.S.-Afghan team killed one of al-Qaeda's top leaders in a Taliban stronghold in Musa Qala in Helmand. The figure, Azimir Umar, died alongside his Taliban compatriots. The Taliban leaders didn't tell the Americans that Umar was enjoying their protection, and they lied about his presence there after the fact. So they're even right now harboring al-Qaeda terrorists. You know, this was the entire reason that the Afghan war started, was because the Taliban was harboring al-Qaeda terrorists. But yet still now we're ready to say to walk away and leave them still doing that. This article concludes, I get why people are sick of talking about Afghanistan and why there is widespread political pressure to just get out. But whitewashing the Taliban on the way out the door is an especially ignoble end, and it puts end in quotes, a way to end America's role in the war. And they're right. I mean, they talked about how that when Mr. Trump came to power, America under Mr. Obama, they already had at least one foot out the door. They were already on the way out there. But that's not a victory. That's a retreat from Afghanistan. It's looking like the Taliban are going to basically have won that war by just outlasting the United States. And that's exactly what we forecast. Even you can go back and look at our Trumpet magazines from 2001. That's what we said right from the start. The Diplomat had an article over the last week as well, why the Taliban won't cut ties with Iran. So they've got ties with Iran, with the world's number one sponsor of terrorism. They're working with Iran. They talk about in that article how U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo accused Iran of undermining the Afghan peace process by using militant groups in the country. So Iran's got militant groups in the country and they're working with the Taliban. Mr. Pompeo said the Taliban's entanglement in Iran's dirty work will only harm the Afghan peace process. And so you've got various different, you know, different groups that are working in Afghanistan that have links to Iran. And this article just goes on to talk about how the two have had some differences in the past, but it's very clear that they're happy to work together. So you're getting America get moving out of the Middle East in, you know, what an ignoble way, as that article talks about. Meanwhile, Europe is looking to get more involved in the Middle East. The EU is getting ready to launch a new naval mission to Libya. They reached this decision on Monday, where they talked about launching a naval mission to enforce an arms embargo on Libya. They talk about using warships, aerial surveillance, satellites, all to crack down on arms smuggling and to, well, there's a UN arms embargo on Libya. No one's meant to be bringing any weapons in. So they're talking about setting up this maritime mission to stop anybody from bringing weapons in and to go and search ships that they find and this kind of thing. They haven't agreed all the details yet, but those EU leaders, they came to an agreement on principle. And that's set to launch by the end of March. Meanwhile, there's another story. This is from Reuters on February 12th. NATO to expand Iraq training mission in response to Trump. So the EU, Europe's, you know, talking about NATO. It's meaning basically America's European NATO partners. America's been doing most of the work there. Well, Europe's looking to get more involved in Iraq as well, to be running more of these training missions, to be putting themselves in harm's way more in Iraq as well. So these are all relatively small steps, I guess you could say, of Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. We've said before, I don't think you will see the massive steps, Europe going to war in a major way, say, until you have that German strongman that we talked about at the start in power there. But so much of the background is there already. Well, we'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk a bit about some important events going on in the Philippines, as well as the Munich Security Conference that took place over the weekend, and its very significant theme of Westlessness. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. Well, like I said, there's been some important events going on in the Philippines, something that could have major geopolitical consequences. On February 11th, the Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte announced that he would be ending the visiting forces agreement between the U.S. and the Philippines. And that starts a six-month countdown, or I think 180-day countdown. And this is the agreement that allows the U.S. to conduct military drills and do training with the Philippines on their soil. But really, this is about a lot more than just the ending of one particular agreement and some of the different details and bits in the treaty that go with it. This could be the end of the U.S.-Philippine alliance, an alliance that's been really important for America projecting power into that region of the world. You know, America has had a presence in the Philippines for basically around 100 years or so. A major part of America's power in that part of the world. The U.S. Embassy in Manila said that the decision was a serious step with significant implications for the U.S.-Philippines alliance. And they're right. The president, Mr. Duterte, he's never really liked this alliance with the U.S. He's been wanting to get out of it, and he's made that very clear pretty much since he was elected. But I think some in the Filipino military were not as keen as he was to get out of that alliance. But I guess after being in power now for several years, he seems like he feels like he's got the power to take this step now. And then, you know, everybody sees this really as potentially the beginning of the end of this relationship. The Lowly Institute had an article pushing the Philippines-US alliance over the cliff, and they wrote that it's not likely that this alliance will survive this episode of mutual disdain. Then on the Atlantic, Duterte's decision nevertheless constitutes the gravest threat to the alliance in years and jeopardizes the US military's effort to deter Chinese aggression in the region. But going back to this Lowly Institute article pushing the Philippine-US alliance over the cliff, they write, without the VFA, the Visiting Fortresses Agreement, the Philippines-US alliance becomes a hollow shell of former formal commitments on paper with no substantial means of implementation for purposes of preventing or responding to security threats. So it makes the whole alliance just a hollow shell. They write, the end of the Philippine-US alliance will create a hole in the US security umbrella that China is poised to fill. Diminished US presence will undoubtedly embolden further adventurism beyond the so-called gray zone. With economic exploitation of the South China Sea already in full swing, China's maritime expansion will consolidate its hold over the first island chain, the weakest link of which is the Philippines. Without a strong and continuing US presence, the archipelago is the ideal security buffer to shield China against external maritime threats. It concludes by saying that Duterte's decision to push the Philippine-US alliance over the cliff seriously affects the geopolitical balance. It will loosen the final restraints of the current regional order and may eventually deliver not only the Philippines but the rest of the region to the tender mercies of a revisionist power. So this is a big deal. The potential for America to get pushed out of here. You know, it's a huge military presence that America's had here. I brought a book with me. I do that sometimes. In the Shadows of the American Century by Alfred W. McCoy. He has some good material just at the start of this book about just some of the effort that America put into some of these military bases and how important they were for the expansion of American military power. But, he talks about how the Ramstein base in Europe, where there were nearly 300,000 workers doing that, building that. The Navy spent $170 million on the Subic Bay port. It's already left that in the Philippines, and there have been Chinese companies showing an interest in moving in on that crucial base there. Then you've got the Clark Field, where that's the home of the 13th Air Force Base. It has the capacity for 200 fighters and a bombing range bigger than the District of Columbia. So these are really key points in America's overseas military presence. In that part of the world. And we've got, I told you I might end up playing with this boat, but we've got our model boat sitting here there, and I believe it's meant to be a model of Nelson's victory. You know, this is the boat that Nelson was on where Britain won the Battle of Trafalgar, and this became a turning point in world history, winning that battle. It meant absolutely beyond any doubt that Britain ruled the waves. And that it was Britain that went and established all of these overseas bases. And Britain became the next significant power for 100 years or more. And people, a lot of people trace that back to, you know, that battle, this ship. And then you look at, well, a lot of those bases in World War II transferred to the United States. America built a huge number of bases. I think it's in this book, about 450 around the world, a global network of 450 military bases in 36 countries, aimed in large part in containing the Sino-Soviet bloc in an iron curtain. So surrounding the world, and that was the basis for America's presence, for the American century that this book talks about. All those different bases. And now America, you see America retreating from these bases. You know, they've already left Subic Bay, but now the potential of being that Filipino alliance ending. There's still the relationship, I guess, with Japan, with South Korea, with Taiwan, with some of those other countries. How long is that going to stick around? It's a major weakening of American power. And it's a big boost to China. And Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he had a Key of David program, I think it was a couple of years ago, where he talked about, well, he's had a few that talked about the rise of China in this area, the massive power that it gives them, being able to control some of these vital sea lanes in and around East Asia. Here's what he said in that Key of David program. This is clip two.
If you look at today at China and how they control that South China Sea and a sea gate that goes through that area, they are able to almost totally control the flow of trade through that sea gate in that area, which amounts to about, I think it's about $5 trillion annually flowing through that area, which means China could absolutely wreck the economies of a lot of countries just by controlling that area. Now, what does it all mean? What do you think all this means? What is it all about? Well, surely, if we stop and think about this, with China doing all that and making all these deals and paying all that money, what is their goal? What is their ambition? Surely we must see a strong motivation there to, take over the world, to conquer the world. And some of the Chinese leaders will even tell you that.
So you've got this rising power there in China. And now you've got the United States potentially drastically reducing their presence and their power in that region. A major step back. And it's a big coup for China. $5 trillion or $5.3 trillion worth of trade coming through that region. You know, that region's not just important for people that live in that region. You know, it's something that affects world trade, the global economy. And there's a reason why Japan kind of went straight for that area right at the start of World War II and kicked the US out of the Philippines. So a major story there. Well, I'll just mention quickly another one with Britain's Royal Navy is falling to the smaller than France's, smaller than Italy's. Its number of frigates and destroyers has fallen to just 15, despite a long-standing government promise that it would always have at least 19 frigates. So Britain's military, you know, a long, long way from the days of Admiral Nelson and ruling the waves. But a very important story to watch there as well. But I might get into some more of some of those details towards the end, but I want to make sure I have time to talk about this Munich Security Conference and their theme of Westlessness. This was the Munich Security Conference is a major foreign policy meeting that takes place every year, every February, in Germany, and you usually get all of the top politicians from Germany there, as well as military leaders and other politicians from the US and elsewhere. It's a great place to look for the foreign policy and the military thinking, especially of Germany. And so this year, the theme is Westlessness. And no, that's not me developing a speech impediment. This was a conference that focused on a fundamental shift in the world order. They were just talking about it's shifting away from the West. You know, that's the way that the world has been viewed for a long time now, that you had the West. You had Britain, America, Canada, Australia, these other countries, and then you had Western Europe and then Eastern Europe after the fall of the Cold War, and they were the West, and they were united, and they had common values, and they had military alliances like NATO that covered a whole load of countries in the West, and a common way of looking at the world and working together, and they were one clear block. And what this conference was acknowledging is that's not true anymore. There is no West. There is no one clear block. And America was there still insisting that they were. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, you know, he was there talking about how the West is winning. The West is stronger than ever. Here's what he said.
Just yesterday, a quote suggesting, quote, that the United States rejects the international community. End of quote. I'm here this morning to tell you the facts. Those statements simply do not affect in any significant way or reflect reality. I'm happy to report that the death of the Transatlantic Alliance is grossly over-exaggerated. The West is winning. We are collectively winning.
And you can see there was no real response from the people in the audience there. You know, you would have thought with some of those, you know, the West is winning, we're winning. Those are normally the applause lines where you get the claps and things like that. And nobody was applauding him because the audience disagreed. the other speakers made it very clear that they disagreed. You know, he was speaking in response to what somebody else was saying. They don't see this transatlantic alliance, this the West, as victorious. Politico made a really good point on this. They wrote that the two sides aren't just far apart on the big questions facing the West, threats from Russia, Iran, and China. They're in a parallel universe. You know, these two parts of the Western alliance, they're not on the same page. They're on different universes. They're in different books. You know, it's completely different views. It's just completely broken up. Now, this trend of Westlessness, this end of the Western alliance, that's something really critical. That's something that ties right in with the prophecy that we've been watching. I mean, if you look at, like I said, all of this kind of overview of some of the big stories that we've looked at in the news over the last week or so, it ties in exactly to the big trends that we're watching here at the Trumpet. You know, the decline of Britain and America and those other countries, the decline of their morals, the decline of their military power. Well, you see that so clearly in so many of those headlines that we see. And then the rise of these other powers, the rise of China, where you see that with China now pulling away key alliances from the United States, basically doing what Japan did in the opening stages of World War I, but peaceably. Or, well, I mean, they've not exactly been peaceably with what they're doing in the South China Sea, but through diplomacy, I should say. You know, through negotiation, pushing America out of the Philippines and gaining that major, major victory. You've got the rise of Iran in the Middle East. And yes, they've had some temporary setbacks with Soleimani, but they're certainly not out. They're certainly not defeated. And we've been talking about how they're going to rise as the king of the South. And you see, well, America's getting ready to come out of Afghanistan, and Iran's got strong links with Afghanistan, and terrorists working there and working elsewhere in the region. You know, the rise of radical Islam and the rise of Iran in the Middle East, another one of the key trends that we've been watching. And then this decline of the West, this Westlessness, you know, that's absolutely fundamental to the message that we give, to what the Bible talks about the world. You know, as Herbert W. Armstrong proved in his free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, while Britain, Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, along with others, including things like the Jewish state of Israel and the Middle East, they're descended from biblical Israel. And there's a whole set of prophecies that talk about what happens to biblical Israel. You know, you've got a whole book, the book of Ezekiel, for example, where Ezekiel's writing about these prophecies that are meant to happen to Israel. And at this time, he's talking about Israel going into captivity. And for somebody living at that time, that could look pretty crazy. You say, well, Israel went into captivity 100 years ago. Why are you writing prophecies about Israel going into captivity? Well, it's because there are modern prophecies for modern Israel, the modern descendants of these tribes. They're forecast to go into captivity. Britain and America, they're on the decline. The Bible makes that very clear. And so the West are on that trajectory. But then meanwhile, the Bible also talks about a European power. There are several places that talk about a beast power, an empire, and other scriptures make clear that this empire, it's a religious power that rises and falls again and again. You can see that in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. You know, Revelation 13 talks about a power that enforces its own system of worship. Revelation 17 talks about a beast that's led by a woman or a church in biblical symbolism. So you've got this religious power, and Revelation 17 talks about, well, there are five kings, and you know, they come and they go. They rise and they fall. And you see in Europe, you have this power that rises and falls, and it's influenced by, it's led by the Catholic Church. And so you see very clear prophecies about that. And the Bible makes it clear, well, this is you can see this in Isaiah chapter 10. Assyria is Germany in biblical prophecy. And God says, well, I'm raising you up to correct Israel. They're the rod that God uses to correct this European power led by Germany, led by Assyria. So, you know, when you look at what people have talked about as the West, this kind of union of Britain and Europe, or America and Europe, well, we've said all along, they're not really united. They're not really one block. One is rising, one is falling. They have completely different histories, different values, completely different destinies in biblical prophecy. And this is becoming so clear that you have one of the top international conferences, certainly the top transatlantic conference, talking about Westlessness, the end of this idea of Britain and America being one unified bloc. Because it's crystal clear now that they're not. And that's what Mr. Armstrong was writing about even as far back as the 20s and the 30s. And you see that worldview being completely vindicated. As I said, it's not even just cherry-picking one or two specific positions. It's the entire worldview that you get based on biblical prophecy. That's what's on display there with the Munich Security Conference. And the other thing that is really interesting to watch at the Munich Security Conference is the role that France plays in this breakup and in this relationship. You saw that really clearly. I mean, Emmanuel Macron was pretty much the star of the show as far as the Europeans were concerned at the Munich Security Conference. Deutsche Welle, I've got a quote from them. They were very enthusiastic about him. They really liked what he was saying. They wrote, "The highlight of the conference was perhaps the appearance of French President Emmanuel Macron. The French president brings incredible dynamism to the European debate. He fights for European independence. He wants a common foreign and defense policy. And if that does not work for all, well, I'll read that a bit later, but he wants this dynamic, powerful Europe. He talks about wanting to make sure Europe is not America's junior partner. He has a much grander destiny in mind." And this is exactly what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been right on top of this story. Here's a quick clip from a Key of David that he gave talking about this subject in December. And he zooms in on this behavior by France and Emmanuel Macron. And then what we saw at the weekend is just a continuation of that. This is clip three.
"Right now, France is attacking President Trump and the United States. And France is fulfilling Bible prophecy. And I want to show you why and how." This is a quote from the New York Post by Mark Moore, December the 3rd, and it reads this way. They're discussing, quote, "the nasty comments from French President Emmanuel Macron that NATO is brain dead because of lackluster U.S. leadership, blaming America for the problem, even though Mr. Trump is just mainly trying to get everybody to pay their dutiful dues to NATO." But it goes on to say, "it's a tough statement when you make a statement like that. That is very, very nasty statement to essentially including them 28 countries, President Trump told a reporter. The article says Macron, in an interview last month with The Economist magazine, said the U.S. is turning its back on us. What we are currently experiencing is the brain death of NATO." Now, those are harsh words. Why is he talking like that?
Why, indeed, why is he talking like that? And that's exactly what you saw him continuing to talk about. Well, he didn't even talk about so much about NATO. I mean, it came up from time to time. But his focus at this conference was right on Europe. You know, not on NATO arming, on NATO doing more, but Europe needs to do more. Europe needs to build its military. He said he's convinced that we need a much stronger Europe in defense. And I think the other thing that was really interesting was just how there was just almost this chorus of German leaders. He had this backup chorus of German politicians who were right there, who every time they got a chance to stand up, were up there saying, "We're right behind you, Emmanuel Macron. We 100%, we completely agree." You had Armin Laschet. He's one of the top candidates to become Germany's next chancellor. He said, "I'd like to apologize on behalf of the German government for not moving more quickly towards a European military the way that Macron wants." The German defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, the former kind of anointed successor of Angela Merkel, she said she completely agreed with Mr. Macron. Heiko Maas, the German foreign minister, talked about how he agreed. He said that when he called for the construction of a European security and defense union. Now, notice what Mr. Fleury talked about this on that same Key of David, just about Germany's role in what Mr. Macron has been doing and saying. This is clip four.
"You have to realize that Germany has been planning this since before World War II ended. Now, we have another booklet you ought to read entitled Germany's conquest of the Balkans. And it shows there is a document inside that booklet that will tell you the very corporations that were involved in doing it, and some of them are very, very popular today. And they wanted to help build this Holy Roman Empire one more time. It's a very dangerous calculation that they're making at this time, but I'll tell you, there is evidence, I think, to support the fact that Mr. Macron would never, ever say what he said unless Germany approved. He is really being a, well, sort of a puppet to Germany.
And that's what you saw, I think, at this Munich Security Conference. Germany certainly does approve. There was a chorus of approval for everything that he said. And Germany's the one really behind this and pushing this. I mean, they're very good at... You often get French leaders that love the attention. And Germany doesn't necessarily want a huge amount of attention drawn to them wanting to become a military power or anything like that. So they're happy to let the French grab the attention while they push it all in a direction that they want to go in. And that's something else that you clearly saw at the Munich Security Conference. And it went so far that at this conference that Mr. Macron was basically even talking about nuclear weapons and bringing up the subject of potentially France being willing to share its nuclear weapons. This is a clip of Mr. Macron at that conference. This is clip one.
Or what are you hinting at? Where would you like to go on this question of nuclear strategy and nuclear defense for Europe, for France in the 21st century?
C'est la question.
So... it's a question of relationships and relations between the ambitions of NATO and Europe. I'm convinced that we need a much stronger Europe in defense. So I think that what we've achieved in the last few years, a European Defense Fund, increased cooperation, a European Intervention Initiative. This is what I said at my Sorbonne speech, that these things are crucial. These things are crucial so that we have European funds available, so that we can develop joint capabilities like the Future Combat Air System or the Main Ground Combat System, MGCS, two great examples for Franco-German cooperation. And we need a joint strategy for defense. And I think we need that due to reasons of sovereignty.
Now, I think it's, you know, Wolfgang Ischinger, the organizer of the conference, when he's interviewing there, you know, he's like, well, what are you hinting at? You keep kind of hinting at things with nuclear weapons. What are you getting at? And he didn't really answer that question. He just gave out more hints, especially as you heard at the end there. That was kind of a bit of a hint that we're willing to share nuclear power. So he's not willing to come out and publicly say anything beyond these hints. But the fact that he's kind of hinting to Germany, and he invited Germany even before the conference, come and let's have some talks about France's nuclear weapons and what we could do to have some kind of European nuclear deterrent so we're not relying on the United States. You know, he's throwing out hints about potentially even France using its nuclear weapons to help form this combined European military. About just having some combined European military force or combined military deterrent, and maybe France being willing to share its nuclear weapons, which is really remarkable. That's a huge investment on building up and empowering this military power. Another thing that what I'll do actually is I'll just play this clip from Mr. Fleury, and then I'll tell you what he talked about afterwards. But this is clip five, and this was another clip that Mr. Fleury talked about from this December Key of David.
So Macron is just floating the idea and letting everybody know that this is what is coming. Germany is going to see to it, whether the rest of Europe likes it or not. And a lot of them are not going to like it. And so it's going to be pared down to 10 kings. The rest of them will exit like Britain is doing even now. And Britain is doing that because they know Europe is anchored to Germany, and they know this is going to end to something very, very dangerously wrong.
So that was Mr. Fleury in December saying, well, not everybody in Europe's going to go along, but France is just going to move on regardless. And you saw literally exactly that at the Munich Security Conference. You did see some European countries indicating, well, we're not too keen on this idea of a combined European military. We would rather stick with our alliance with the US, thank you very much, rather than creating a strong European power. And Emmanuel Macron said, well, fine, we're happy to move on with just a quote-unquote core group of countries. If not everybody is interested in this, we'll move on with just a smaller group. Exactly what Mr. Fleury said in December, that they would happen, that they would do that. And why did Mr. Fleury say that in December? Well, because the Bible says that. Those same scriptures that I talked about, Revelation 17, it talks about 10 kings. You look at Europe, there's 27 different leaders in Europe right now. It was 28. It's pared down already. We said that Britain would leave. They have. And so now you've got this, in Europe, you've got this talk of potentially just a smaller group moving forwards. And the Bible says, well, it's just 10 kings, 10 leaders. So really, everywhere you look, you just see all of the broad trends that we've been forecasting for years, Herbert W. Armstrong for decades, the Bible for millennia, playing out before your eyes. You know, it's the whole world view of world events comes right from this book. So that's a really remarkable thing to look at. You know, keep watching that. There's so many more prophecies that I wish I could have gotten into today. Maybe I should have given less of an overview to do that. But if you haven't read it already, read our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That gives you that broad overview. You know, this is who Israel is. This is who Europe is. This is the broad overview of Bible prophecy. And then you can watch and just see all of your headlines conform to that broad overview. I mean, Mr. Armstrong talked about what an exciting book that was, because it really makes the Bible come alive. It makes, you know, world events, daily world events, proof of what the Bible says, proof that God inspired the Bible thousands of years ago. So that's a wonderful place to go to learn more about this. That's about it from me. I think we've got another special guest host from headquarters tomorrow. You can tune in on 101.3 on the FM dial, online at kpcg.fm, or of course on our YouTube stream as well.